We read for you. Atlantis, the Dark Continent. A book by Paul Williamson and Linda Braithwaite. Read by JP on Wolf Spirit Radio. Atlantis, the Dark Continent. You're listening to Wolf Spirit Radio.
Welcome to Wolf Spirit Radio.
Now we're back and I can see, which is altogether a better thing than before. Right. Now, I'm reading part... this must be part 10, I believe. Yes. Part 10 of Atlantis, the Dark Continent. I realise that. I'm listening on the jingle that I made. Yeah, it goes, Atlantis. Like, just the right, a proper Cockney. Anyway, just goes to show you. I have got a twang, if anybody ever hears it. I have a twang in there. Well, that's where I come from. Anyway. So, Atlantis, the Dark Continent. Now, I am on chapter 16, The Rise of the Military. And I just read, my last episode was Paul's regression, and so now this is Linda's regression. This is the other half of the team who wrote this. This is Linda Braithwaite. So this is her recollections as Tasha. I'm galloping fast across the sands of a semicircular bay. The wind is in my hair and the sun shining. It is a glorious day. My horse is moving smoothly and his hooves are thundering on the wet sand. I feel free. I love to escape the crowds of the city for a while and come here. It is wonderful. I just wish this horse was mine. He belongs to a friend of my father's who allows me to borrow him in return for some light chores. It is my dream to have horses of my own. One day I will. I am 15 now. An only child and living with my parents. We get along well, although I tend to be a bit of a loner, preferring to be on my own and having few friends. My father is a fine craftsman and well respected. He makes harness and tack for horses. His work is beautiful and ornate. He decorates the leather with intricate patterns using silver and gold. A lot of rich people come to him for his fine things. Mother does colourful embroidery on saddlecloths and blankets, using rich silks and precious stones. People pay huge amounts for some of her work. They want me to follow them into the family business. But I don't want that. I want to rise higher. There is no status for me in being a craft worker, no matter how good. I intend to go into the military service, rise through the ranks and become a senior officer, perhaps even in command of the fortress. Then I would be well respected, have position and influence in the community, and be able to own and ride the finest horses. Our city is situated around two bays. Oh, the story candle. Our city is situated around two bays. Each on either side of a high, rocky headland, on which is the military headquarters in the fortress. It is very old, some say hundreds of years. The fortress was built there because of its strategic position as it overlooks our busy harbour, which is to the east of it. I'll start that again. Two bays, high bays, rocky headland, military headquarters, very old. The fortress was built there because it was... The fortress was built there because of its strategic position as it overlooks our busy harbour, which is to the east of it. Many hundreds of thousands of people live here. It is very crowded. There are steep wooded hills behind us, preventing any further expansion. We're on the northernmost tip of our land, with other cities southwards along the eastern coast. Many beautiful squares and marketplaces adorn our city, and there is a large university situated at the back of the city, where the ground begins to rise. We are a busy commercial center, mainly situated round the harbor. The military keep law and order and would defend us from any invaders. But there have been no problems for years. There are severe punishments. I'm not reading very well today. I'll edit that out. Beep, beep, beep. Yeah, bye-bye. Anyway, there are severe punishments. Oh, this is such a serious book. All right, okay. Cup of tea. Cup of tea always works. Is anyone listening? I'd welcome any feedback live in the chat room in wolfspiritradio.com/wolfchat. I appreciate feedback. Okay, so the military keep law. Really? Come on. The military keep law and order and would defend us from any invaders, but there have been no problems for years. There are severe punishments for stealing and murder. These people are executed, but I've never seen anything like that. Most of the population are law-abiding, although there are the odd flare-ups of trouble now and again. Now I have finished my course of training, and I am a junior officer. Men and women are completely equal here, so I have as good a chance as anyone of rising to high rank. I am enjoying my life here. What gives me pleasure is to wear my fine uniform and to have command over people. My dream is to own and ride a fine horse. Being now in charge of many men, I am leading 20 of them down the narrow alleys of the seedier side of town. There's been a lot of subversive activity going on lately, based mainly in the university. They want rid of us to stop military rule. These people must be rooted out because they are dangerous. They feel our way is wrong, and we should hand over to a civilian government. It is horrible here. How do people live in this rat-infested place? It's obvious we're not liked, but that doesn't matter because we have a job to do. We're here to find and arrest one of the alleged leaders of the subversive movement and take him in for questioning. Approaching his house carefully, we need the element of surprise if we are to find our man. I order my men to surround the building. These people are undermining our authority and trying to turn the population against us. We try to prevent them meeting, but this is difficult in a city as densely populated as this. We arrest and imprison those we find. This is considered a treasonable offence, a crime against the state, and as such is punishable by death. The men are signalling they are all in position. We break down the door, go in and up some stairs. There is a shout of triumph, for he is here. We have him. My men have done well. We will take him to the barracks and interrogate him, needing to find out what and who he knows. I have no feeling or sympathy for him, just contempt. This man is to be questioned with torture. The more senior officers are doing this. I am here to observe and learn techniques. Initially, he refuses to answer our questions, which is what we expected. We attach devices to his limbs, which will gradually be tightened, breaking his bones. This causes intense pain. I didn't really want to be here. and thought I would react badly. But I don't seem to be too bothered. It's not as bad as I expected. They are our enemies and do not matter. Reacting to our torture, he is screaming and swearing at us. However, we are getting a lot of information and names from him. He thinks that by talking he has saved his life, but we will kill him as a traitor anyway. The officer in charge tells me to go and arrest those he has named. He implies that if I do this well, I will get the promotion I want. Asking him if it matters if any of them die, he says, "Not particularly if they resist arrest, but we do need some more for further interrogation and to execute as an example to others." I am on my way to carry out my orders, walking through the streets with my men. There are catcalls from around us, but we are here not to be popular. Many of those involved in this are from the educated classes, quite a few from the university, which means that a lot of students there are also in the revolutionary groups. They have many resources and can reach a lot of people. There is a lot of rebellion here. We may have to use force, as there is a possibility of resistance. The man we are going to arrest is one of the tutors. He's a known dissident, and has been distributing information in printed sheets and things like that. He's a bad troublemaker and needs to be silenced. We're in the house, and my men search and find him, saying that I am arresting him as an enemy of society. He tries to bluff his way out. I think about killing him, but decide to take him back for torture and execution. That is what I will do. Reporting back to the military commander, he is pleased. I did well resisting the urge to kill him on the spot. He wants to question him. Then I will definitely get a command position. There is one man in the way of my promotion, a wealthy officer who has been here a little longer than me. He owns a stable of fine horses and comes from a rich family. I need to get rid of him. That would leave the way clear for me, and I could take his horses. Going to see the man I have arrested, I persuade him to name my rival as an accomplice. If he does this, although I cannot save his life, I assure him that I can make sure his death is quick and painless. I am in one of the rooms reserved for this purpose. The two victims are ready, prepared for me. The method we use is to secure the prisoner to an upright rectangular wooden frame, arms and legs fixed to each corner, the body exposed and spread-eagled. They are naked. We use a special long-bladed knife and kill them by plunging this through the chest. If done properly and with skill, death is instantaneous and almost painless. Of course, if you do not aim exactly, the victim bleeds to death slowly and in pain. Sometimes I choose to do this. The first man is shouting at me, cursing me. I was going to spare him pain, but he has made me angry, and is trying to make a fool of me in front of my fellow officers. I decide to cut out his tongue and castrate him before I kill him, to increase his suffering as a punishment for his attitude. It will be also interesting for the other, my former colleague, to watch as he is the next to die. Okay. Trigger alert, folks. You might not want to listen to this. Putting a metal clamp in his mouth to keep it open, I select a small knife and cut his tongue out. There is much blood, and I need to wipe my hands before proceeding. Selecting another knife, I take hold of his genitals and cut through them. He loses consciousness. So I order the soldiers to burn bitter herbs under his nose to revive him for the final blow. When he is awake and aware, I take the special knife and plunge it into his chest. He dies instantly. Turning my attention to the second man, This is the officer whose horses are now mine. He is terrified and pleased with me to spare him pain. Ignoring him, I taunt him before castrating him. I've also decided to make him die slowly, and so I push the knife in slightly low, cutting him open down the belly, leaving him to die in pain. Making my way to the stables, I take his finest horse, a magnificent golden chestnut with a white flash on his face. He is mine now. I am riding down the steeply wooded slopes at the back of the city, having been out with a fellow officer, Petri. He is so handsome. We have been together for the day, and it has been wonderful. Needing to keep our relationship quiet, we part company and enter the city by different routes. By different routes, to avoid comment. You have to be careful. No one will know. It is our secret. Now I am in the barracks and have just received an urgent message. I have to go quickly. There has been a fire at my father's business. The place has been burned down. People are saying they are dead. Riding there as swiftly as I can, it takes me some while because it is right across the city. When I arrive, my heart sinks. There is nothing left. The building is completely gone. There is just empty space. Nothing. I can't believe it. I don't want to believe it. It has happened in the early hours. They are both dead. They were trapped upstairs. Nothing could be done. They're gone. There's nothing. I walk through the wreckage of my home, searching, looking for anything that might be left of them. My feet crunch on ash and blackened timber. The walls are scorched. It must have been an inferno. Feelings well up inside of me in sadness and loss. I am distraught, but I must not show it. People are watching. I am an army officer, and so I must be strong. There's quite a crowd now. I know I'm not liked. I feel this fire has been deliberate. They've killed my parents to get at me. Feeling rage and anger build up inside of me, I decide that someone will pay for this. I will take my revenge. I will organize arrests and make the victim suffer for what they have done as a deterrent. Seeing something bright glinting in the blackened remains, I pick it up. It is a tiny silver horse's head, which would have been used as a harness decoration. Cleaning it up, I put it in my pocket. It is all that I have. Nothing else. Just memories. Feeling tears coming, I choke them back angrily. I sense the people laughing at me behind my back. My life here is finished. The culprits will suffer. I will make sure of that. I'm preparing to torture one of the men arrested following the fire. I know him, for he is the husband of an old friend of mine. He thinks this will save him, but it will not. We have arrested 7 men altogether. He is the first to die. The others are watching. His family has gone into hiding, and I need to take them also as a lesson to others. He will tell me where they are, and I will torture him. I will make sure of it. Intending to burn him slowly, I have attached him to the usual frame and naked. Applying a burning firebrand to the soles of his feet, he starts to scream and curse. I ask him where his family are. He curses and spits at me. Moving the flames to his genitals, he screams more and more, eventually telling me what I need to know. Now I can kill them as well. The room is filled with the smell of burning flesh. He loses consciousness again. I order the men to burn herbs to revive him. Being angry with him, I push the fire into his face before taking the knife and killing him. He dies quickly. I am riding up a winding cobbled street between tall buildings which are wider on the upper levels. Leaning across the saddle, I am looking intently for the house where my former friend and family are hiding. When I reach the place, I post 2 soldiers I have brought with me for protection as sentries and go in. The woman is there with 5 children. They are the ones I want. She was my friend once, but no longer. She is the wife of a traitor. Drawing my sword, I thrust it through her stomach. She falls to the floor, but not dead. I go to the children. They have gone into a terrified huddle in a corner. The youngest is a boy of about 2. He is clinging to the knees of an eldest girl. Grabbing his hair, I pull him away, draw my knife, and cut his throat. I repeat this with the others until I get to the eldest. She appears to be in shock, frozen, rigid. I plunge my knife through her chest and pull downwards, cutting her open. This done, I return to the mother, who is still alive, and push my sword through her chest to kill her. Scattering lamp oil around and lighting it, I leave as the fire takes hold. Mounting my horse, I do not look back. Returning to my quarters one evening, I walk along an upper corridor with windows that overlook an inner courtyard. My eye is drawn to a movement in a far corner under some arches. I feel a sudden shock in my heart. It is Petri. He is in a passionate embrace with another woman, and I recognize her. Eurydacia, one of the junior officers. Feeling rage building up inside me, I feel he has betrayed me, having gone with her. They are kissing. I thought he was mine. Now I see him with someone else. How could he do this to me? He will pay for this. I will confront him. I stand and watch, seething with anger, till they walk away, arms around each other, and vanish into the shadows. I am on my way to his rooms to confront him, in my full armor and carrying my weapons, feeling that I may need them. Opening the door, I walk in. There is no one in the outer area. They are in bed together. I knew they would be. As he looks up in horror, I scream abuse at him for what he has done. He jumps out of bed to answer me. Hitting him across the face with my armored glove, he falls to the floor, stunned. She is in bed, cowering under the bedclothes, naked, trying to cover herself. Drawing my sword, I snatch away the covers and plunge it through her chest. Blood pours out and she dies. I turn to him. He has got up and grabbed his own sword. Although he comes at me, he is at a disadvantage as he is naked, and I am in full armor. He doesn't stand a chance. I run my sword through him, and he falls across his lover on the bed. Standing to regain my breath and temper, I look for a while, then leave. It is becoming clear that our commanding officer, Arune, is favoring a negotiated settlement with the civilian leaders. This is a weakness. I do not understand why he has changed so much. He has become soft and he is giving in to them. He is also frowning on our methods, especially mine. I have been told off severely, having to do as he says, or he has threatened to take me down in rank. How dare he? How can he? We need to get rid of him. Then I, as second in command, can take charge and get some much-needed discipline back into the situation, instead of giving in to their demands. Deciding to set him up, I pretend to capitulate and go along with his wishes. I agree to accompany him to a meeting at the university with their leaders to negotiate a settlement to the unrest. I will go there and have some of my own men hidden. At the right moment, I will denounce him as traitor, arrest him for treachery, and execute him. Perfect. The place will run more efficiently without him. He's got too lenient of late. All is planned. We are in a high-ceilinged hall at the university, and are with the senior members of the civilian groups. Commander Arune is sitting at a long table with them. I am standing against the wall, close behind him, near a door. I know my men are in position. The delegates are talking intently. When I give the signal, my men rush up. Accusing him of treachery, I order his arrest. Looking at me in realization and horror, he knows I have organized this. Without warning, he stands, turns, and draws his sword in one swift movement and comes directly at me. I am taken by surprise. He's attacking me. Caught off guard, I am trapped by the wall behind me, just having time to draw my dagger from my belt before he is upon me. He is a good swordsman and soldier. I find it difficult to defend myself as we close together. He's strong. Suddenly, I manage to drive my dagger into his chest. He gasps and slowly falls to the floor. He's dead. I know somehow that this is what he intended. He forced me to kill him. He deliberately forced my hand. I have been in charge for some time now. I have many enemies and have to pay private bodyguards to protect me. One day, I decide, on almost a whim, to go and visit an ancient earth sanctuary in the mountains behind the town. I mustn't let anyone except my trusted guards know where I am going. Not quite knowing the reason for me going there, I feel a strange urge, almost a compulsion, to visit it. Telling my military colleagues that I am making a round of inspections to our guard post on the outskirts of the city, I go to an inn on the edge of the forest, slip inside and change out of my uniform into a maidservant's dress. I feel that I need to be in disguise somehow. It feels strange. I've worn uniform for so many years. I set off up the path, which is steep and climbs up through dense trees. It is stepped in some of the more difficult sections. The ascent takes some time and rises high above sea level. It is silent deep within these ancient trees. Fingers of mist creep between their trunks, and there is a peculiar atmosphere. This is a strange place. Why have I come here? I catch my breath in places, feeling scared, odd. Eventually, I come out onto a wide, flat, circular area which is surrounded by a ring of venerable trees, tall and imposing. The sense of time here is amazing. I feel overawed, frightened, and uneasy. I do not know why I am reacting like this, and it disturbs me. The center of the circle is neatly clipped grass, upon which is etched an interwoven pattern of flowing lines in pale stones. In the very center is a tree stump, on top of which is a metal bowl in which a flame is burning, and around it are fresh flowers. This place feels sacred, and I feel the need to kneel. Even with part of me feeling so out of place, I bow my head towards the center, uncertain of what to do. Suddenly my heart jumps, becoming aware of a tall figure walking towards me across the circle. He is dressed in dark robes and is hooded. Lowering my head again, I don't want to look at him. I feel a deep sense of peace coming from him. Gently, he lays his hands on my bent back. Then he takes my chin and, lifting my face, looks deep into my eyes. He calls me by my name. He knows me. I am so scared. His eyes are deep pools of love and compassion. They look into my soul. His touch reminds me of my father. How much I miss him. I still think of him. He cared for me. Looking away, I am unable to hold his gaze. I don't like the feelings welling up inside me. Scrambling up in a panic, I turn and run away down the path, almost falling on the steeper sections. Feeling angry, foolish, and shaking, I return to the inn, change back into my comforting, familiar uniform, sort my thoughts out, and try to get back to normal. The whole episode has unnerved me. I am standing on the high part of the battlements. It is the middle of the night, about 3 hours after midnight. Everything is still, and the sea is calm. I am alone, wrapped in a warm cloak, gazing out across the water. The sky is clear, and the light of the full moon is sparkling on the water. It is incredibly peaceful. Many thoughts are going through my head. I could not sleep. They are thoughts I don't like. I am not happy. I don't know what to do. I cannot alter things now. I have felt strange since I visited the sanctuary in the forest. Vaguely disturbed somehow. Something in my life doesn't feel right. I feel so alone, so isolated, having not had a partner for a long time. They are afraid of me. I feel things ought to be different. But I cannot undo what has been done. I have to remain strong. I need to clear my head and get back to disciplined thought. It is dawn. I am leaving the fortress on my favourite horse, Captain. I will go for a long gallop to clear my thoughts. Two of my bodyguards are following me. I ride down onto the vast expanse of wet sand that is exposed at low tide. The air is sharp and clear, and it feels good. Urging my horse to a fast gallop, his hooves thunder on the sand. Water flying from them as we race along. This is wonderful. His action is so smooth, so graceful. We are flying. Looking over my shoulder, I notice that my two guards are falling behind. Their horses are no match for Captain's speed. Ahead of me is a grassy promontory with a wide belt of trees along it. There is a path through which leads to another long stretch of sand. Racing along the beach and up onto the turf without slackening speed, the belt of trees is directly ahead, and I moved quickly towards the green tunnel that goes through them. The sound of Captain's hooves change as we enter the green shadows. Suddenly, he is falling. He has been brought down. Crashing heavily to the ground together in a flurry of movement, I swiftly disengage my feet from the stirrups and roll free as I have learned, keeping myself clear of flailing hooves. Then I am attacked. Figures are kicking me. I roll in a ball to protect myself. I cannot draw my weapons. Then I am hit on the head and lose consciousness. Someone throws water on my face and I wake up spluttering. Sheer terror comes over me as I realize I cannot move. I am on my back, arms and legs outstretched, wrists and ankles tied firmly to stakes, totally naked. Squirming briefly, I find I can only move a little. Five cloaked and masked men are silently watching me. I am terrified, but must not show it. That is what they want. They want to see my fear. Swallowing the rising panic inside me with great effort, I listen as one speaks to me. He says I am to be executed, and I will die slowly, suffering like those I have killed and tortured. I want to cry out, but dare not. I am so scared. Raping me in turn, they encourage each other. I close my eyes, trying to ignore the intense feelings of pain and revulsion flowing through my body. When this is over, I realize one of them is kneeling between my outstretched legs. He is holding a long-bladed dagger. Inside my head, I am screaming silently. He plays with me, gently and deliberately stroking the flat of the blade along my thighs, tasting blood in my mouth from biting my lips. I try to hold back the overwhelming urge to cry out. "This is for my sister." He thrusts the knife into my vagina. I cannot hold back any longer. It is agony, terrible agony. Hearing myself crying and screaming, he cuts me as much as possible as tears roll down my face. Standing up, he leaves the knife in me. Silence descends. Slowly, I become aware of two of them standing over me on either side, holding a long, sharpened stake of wood. I realize with utter horror what they intend. Again, they play with me, running the point of the stake down over my body, slowly drawing it between my breasts. Hesitating, then they move it lower, holding it against my belly. I've never felt fear like this. They are deliberately making me wait. Two of them push downwards. The stake slices through me and into the earth below. The pain is indescribable. I scream and writhe as they hammer it firmly into position. Blood seeps out slowly. I cannot stop myself moaning. I know it will take hours for me to die. They settle down to watch. My body feels cold, very strange. Trying to escape by allowing my consciousness to drift, they keep me awake by hitting my face or pushing my body against the stake to increase the pain and bleeding. I am afraid of death. I know I am dying, and I'm so frightened. There is so much pain. This is what I have inflicted on others. All the people I have tortured and killed. Their faces swim before me. Please let me die quickly. Take away this pain. Tears flow as I realize how they must have felt. They begged for mercy and I ignored them, leaving them to die in agony. Now I am in the same position, helpless, alone, and afraid. And there is no mercy for me. After many hours, I gradually become aware that I cannot feel anything anymore. I feel numb and drifting. Eventually, after all the terrible agony, I float free of my body. I know I have died, and it feels very peaceful. I look down on the scene. It is horrible. One of the men gets up, kicks my body, and realizes I am dead. They cut my head off, laughing, pile wood around and burn it. Watching for a while, not knowing what to do, then I feel that wonderful peace again. There is love, like I felt at the sanctuary in the forest. Drifting up over the trees, there is a presence here, a figure of light. She is beautiful, full of brilliance, and she is taking me with her. There are others. My parents, they are here. Oh, it's wonderful to see them. They look so well. We hug each other delightedly. Tears of joy roll down my cheeks. I haven't felt love like this for so long. So very, very long. My guide takes me to face someone else. Oh, no. Commander Aruni. I don't want to see him. I am filled with guilt for how I betrayed him for my own selfish ambition. I see now he was a kind man and cared deeply for peace and the well-being of the people. As he smiles and forgives me, this makes me uncomfortable and increases my feelings of shame. He says, "I was almost there. After my visit to the sanctuary, I was changing." With Aruni, I see others and realize with a renewed shame that these people were all my victims. This is too much. My knees give way and I sink to the ground in tears and beg their forgiveness. The sheer horror of all my terrible actions seems so clear, so awful. How I wasted that life. How did I allow myself to go so terribly wrong? All the torture, deaths and executions, so dreadful. I know now I will have to repay these things and experience a lot of these challenges again. My lady smiles at me with kindness, and deep compassion. She understands. She explains that when I am ready, I will need to evaluate and work with my soul's path. But now I need to recover, rest, and allow myself to heal. Tasha, some thoughts in conclusion. This is Linda speaking. I began to realize, as I looked at the work I had done on Tasha, that although I had written her experiences as I lived through them in regression, there were feelings deep within her that I had, and she had, failed to acknowledge. I could see all too clearly what had caused her to behave as dreadfully as she did. Inside, I was acutely aware of a vulnerable and lonely little girl who desperately needed love and kindness. The tragic death of her parents affected her deeply, but she suppressed the strong feelings of emptiness and loss that she felt. Soon after this, she was betrayed by her lover, Petri. This emphasized her existing feelings of rejection and loneliness, and because she refused to accept her more gentle self and allow the emotions to show, the pent-up energies turned into rage and violence. She successfully buried her feelings of love and compassion for many years, till her visit to the Earth Sanctuary stirred these emotions she did not want to accept. She experienced great fear at the sensations of love that welled up from inside, beginning very reluctantly to see the horror of what she was doing. It was too late. Her fate was already decided, and the lessons were to be learned at another time. I have found writing this chapter an emotional and difficult exercise. As the explorations continued, I accessed the very dark side of her. There are again experiences I feel I have had to leave out of this transcript. While writing some of the more traumatic scenes, my hands froze and I had to stop. I felt strange, an overwhelming sadness took me over, and tears flooded down. Graphic details of scenes of torture and bloodshed swam before me. It was horrible. This happened frequently, and I have learned to deal with these incidents by breaking off and going to do something mundane, like the washing up. As I worked with Paul on this, feelings within my present self began to surface, and I realized somewhat reluctantly that they mirrored Tasha's feelings. Sensing that I was much more like Tasha than I wanted to be, I too had buried my own emotions in a very similar way. However, instead of reacting with violence as Tasha did, I had tended to turn my emotions in on themselves, leading to ill health and depression. During my life, I have felt very afraid of violence and never wanted to express that towards others. Acknowledging Tasha's life has been a very difficult but freeing and healing experience. With Paul's guidance, I am learning to express my feelings more easily now and allow myself to be more me. Karmic consequences. The experience of being Tasha has been very difficult for Linda. This must be Paul speaking. Over and over again, we have needed to go through aspects of Tasha's life, drawing out more details and releasing feelings. The whole experience has haunted Linda at times. I feel that she has been very, very brave to face up to it. Having created so many victims in that life, Linda's soul needed to learn what it was to be like on the receiving end of such brutality. The way that Tasha died started a process of redressing that balance. How Tasha suffered then was very similar to the nature of the torture that she put many of her victims through. As she has mentioned, in her account of Tasha's life, Linda has omitted many instances of sexual abuse, torture, and murder which she had to endure in regression. Linda has become aware that her own character and background has some similarities with that of Tasha. As she has written, Linda is horrified by violence and very fearful of it. She would never want to express that side of herself and would turn those feelings in upon herself rather than hurt anyone else. Linda has identified souls who were her victims in Tasha's life as being people who have oppressed her in her present life, or in some cases, as people she has needed to help this time around. This has been painful learning. It appears that in her present life, Linda's soul has been trying to redress some of the karma engendered by Tasha all those thousands of years ago. From this experience, another thing which Linda's soul has had to learn is how to cope with being this type of character without turning to violence. Actually, her soul did attempt to do this one more time towards the end of Atlantis' history. She chose a personality who was strong-minded and ambitious, but also sensitive and somewhat isolated. This life certainly had its chances where she could have responded to situations more positively. But when she was tested, she did not manage to learn her lessons, and the patterns of Tasha were repeated. We have not included details of that regression in this book. Connections. Denise featured in Tasha's life as one of her victims, a child. Independently of Linda, Denise has been through this regression. It was one where a lot of fear and terror was blocked in Denise's throat center. Going through this was quite harrowing for Denise, but it has cleared her self-expression with her voice, and she has gained more self-confidence to speak and sing as a result of accessing this lifetime. At first, we did not think that Lynn was involved in any of this at this time. But then, as she was typing the transcript of Tasha, Lynn felt some very strong body sensations and resistance when she typed the sequence where Tasha was killing the children. Soon afterwards, both Linda and Lynn realized that they had met then. From another episode than the one which we have included, Lynn was a mother whose children were killed in front of her by Tasha in appalling ways. Then she was killed herself. It appears that Lynn, Denise, and I, in our various character guises, appeared in Tasha's life to give her opportunities to turn away from violence. Because of her great love for each of us as souls, there are moments when she could have changed, but she didn't, and the three of us suffered as a result. In her last life upon Atlantis before its destruction, Linda's soul experienced a very painful life as a victim. It was a short life. However, we found that it links directly with that of Tasha. Linda has sensed that the souls of the people who abused her in this life were the same as some of them of those whom she abused as Tasha. Then, in the manner of her death, being impaled upon a rock, she was impaled through the same part of her body where she used to impale others as Tasha when she wanted to make her victims suffer. Linda needed a lot of support to go through this life. This girl's name was Mina, and she was only a young girl when she died. But the life contained numerous horrific instances of different forms of abuse, so that it seemed that this lifetime was at least a partial redressing for some of the excesses of Tasha's actions. No doubt, many other lives have been needed to rebalance things completely. Parting. This is Paul. I did not enjoy going through my experience in regression as Commander Aruni. I did not like his ambition, and his inclination towards a military career felt very alien to me. In fact, I was very much relieved when my session into this life was over. However, I have come to understand that this may have been an important life for me, because I managed to renounce violence and allow expression of my compassionate self after starting on a path in that life which could have become very negative. I have others to thank for helping me with this. I believe that I have learned and gained a lot through that life and the choices which I made. For Linda, of course, as Tasha, the outcome was very different. We both sensed that following on from this shared experience, we did not meet again in physical life for a considerable time. We estimate that these military lifetimes occurred about 12,000 BC, which is approximately 2,000 years before the final destruction of Atlantis. Linda's soul continued to have her physical incarnations only upon Atlantis until that end. We believe that the next time I met her as a soul was in Egypt, after Atlantis had gone. You're listening to Wolf Spirit Radio.